is what is Trump decided to ignore all the international norms again, as he did in 2018, and to impose, he tried to impose his will in the United States of America on Iran, to deny it its own civil nuclear program, to dismantle it in totally. This is what the Americans want, since this is what Netanyahu wants.
Okay. All right, well, Seth Mossad, I mean, your perspective about the snapback, and let's start a little bit before that. In your opinion, did Iran gain anything by signing the JCPOA?
Nothing. The Americans never, ever lifted sanctions. The Europeans never lifted sanctions. In fact, the Americans under Trump, of course, went into an even heavier set of full-spectrum sanctions and have been continuing to increase those incrementally since they pulled out and they walked out of this JCPOA agreement, which made it effectively defunct and dead from that point. The reality is that I think Iran has been trying to offset at least the full set of sanctions which the UN had imposed, which I think mean there's a greater pressure on military arsenal and equipment, etc., and it makes it a little bit more difficult, but not that much more. The full set sanctions that Trump has overseen during his two terms so far have meant that Iran are completely hemmed in by those sanctions, and they've only been able to, I guess, keep a lifeline going with, one, the resistance economy itself, two, the support of the Iranian public, and, of course, three, China and the likes of Russia, who've still been able to do deals and are beginning to do more deals without the use of the dollar. And, of course, Russia has just signed a huge $25 billion contract with Iran, just as China had done before it. So there is still that hope that the lifeline that the Eurasian Axis gives Iran could allow it to weather these sanctions and these terrorist acts. They're acts of economic terrorism. This is what Trump is doing. This is what the Europeans are doing, because it's part of a full-spectrum attack on Iran, both using, they'll use cyber web technology, they will use grassroots insurgencies, they will use terrorists within Iran, as they did during the 12-day war recently. They will use insurgencies from outside Iran. Some of the groups that are lined up on the borders of Iran are also preparing for attacks, no doubt. Israel itself has got the bit between its teeth. It thinks that this kind of triumphalism that they've whipped up amongst the Western Zionists, that somehow they can destroy Iran through forever war and through the latest 12-day war which they painted as a victory for themselves, saying that they weakened the defense mechanisms of Iran and they can finish the job in another track. It's quite delusional, I think. And of course, that delusion you can't change, because the establishments here in the West, this Troika, America, they're basically Zionists. They're absolutely infiltrated by Zionists, and the Zionists control the foreign policies of Britain, the West, and generally, of course, America.
Right, right. Well, Saad, what do you make of the UN Security Council's vote on not to delay for six more months of implementing the snapback sanctions while talks take place?
It's exactly as my friend Sayed was saying, and the president of Iran, when he said, Bazilgian, the Americans want us to hand over all our enriched uranium, and in return they give us only 3 months. This is unacceptable, as he said. This is where is the denial of the 6 months by United Nations Security Council. The America want to start to impose heavy blows at Iran. But we can understand the Iranian economy when Bazilgian himself, he said, if we have to choose between America's illogical demands and the snapback mechanism, our choice as Iranian will be the snapback mechanism. A prospect of economic impact by this reimposing UN sanctions will be driven merely by psychological responses, that rather than by immediate and concrete economical impact. The UN Security Council resolution hold little or even insignificant kind of effect compared to what my friend was alluding to, the U.S. sanctions imposed by Trump and his Western allies after he abandoned himself in 2018, the JCPOA, with a tweet showing insult to the international community. We have to understand here that the snapback primary targets a dual use nuclear and missile related kind of activities. And it does not plainly reimpose what you can widespread economic sanctions on oil exports or banking or trade. Most of these sectors already been sanctioned before by the US and the and Europeans from 2017, even before that. As well Sayed said, they never lifted their sanction. In reality, that makes the impact of the snapback mechanism less severe and to a lot of people what they expecting is going to affect the economic sectors. It's only fears that will go ahead.
Okay. Well, Sayed Mohsen, I mean, let's talk about the overall hypocrisy of this. I mean, while the Zionist regime continues with his genocide and the use of illegal weapons in Gaza and have possession of nuclear weapons, the so-called international community does nothing to the regime but focuses on Iran, which has regularly been involved in negotiations over its peaceful nuclear program and has abided by its commitments.
Israel is not affected or a member of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. That's a crime, an absolute global crime. Israel has nuclear weapons, up to 400 at the least, from our understanding, and of course has been exposed for that by the Times in England long ago. Vanunu and all of that revelation was clear to the whole world. Yet here we have a United Nations and a world UNGAR basically ignoring Israel and its threat to the entire region and indeed the entire world with this arsenal of nuclear weapons which goes uninspected, unregulated, unchecked and unacknowledged. And the reason the Americans don't acknowledge it is because the minute they acknowledge that the Israelis actually have weapons formally, that would mean that the AIEA would be officially obliged to then rein Israel in. And of course, they would also have to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So there's this rather pathetic, hypocritical game which the Americans have got going, which the whole world knows about, and yet can't seem to do anything about it. This is what bothers me about the current international structures, that they seem to quickly impose sanctions on Russia and Iran. They can quickly impose all sorts of other sanctions on governments that they, the Americans, dictate to them need to be, if you like, punished. Yet when it comes to Israel, there's absolutely nothing that can be done. However, one word of hope is that the Colombian leader just recently has begun to trigger a mechanism within the UN, which will hopefully try to at least bring Israel to book through the possibility of a vote amongst the general UN body to actually trigger some sort of military intervention inside Palestine and Gaza.
Right.
That doesn't stop their attacks on Iran. It is really just these hawks who think they can. They can engineer regime change inside Iran. They're absolutely hell-bent. They're desperate. They think that's their last chance. Because what will happen is, even if they do that, Marzia, what will happen in Iran? You'll get more power going to the IRGC. They'll have to step in and take even more control, which is against whatever these Zionists want. And the convulsive changes that might take place in their dreams would simply mean the nation would slide into an even more anti-U.S. imperialism state. So they're going to
indeed.
Defeat
them. Stay with me, Sayed Mohsen. Stay with me. Sorry to interrupt you. But, Saab, I mean, it was the United States which originally left the JCPOA and pressured the Europeans not to abide by it. But at the same time, it's Tehran that is being hit with more sanctions. I mean, doesn't this just highlight the level of hypocrisy of this so-called international rules-based system?
We understand that the hypocrisy exists before even the nuclear JCPOA program. It started with Iran from 1979, with the Iranian Revolution, since the United States of America deployed after the coup on Mossadegh in 1953, Shah of Iran, to be the policeman of the region and to loot the wealth of Iran, denying the Iranian people their own wealth, and to export that was to the British and then to the Americans. But since the Iranian Revolution, America is doing its best with all the Western alliance to collapse Iran, not even to reach the stage of regime change, to divide Iran to multi-ethnic kind of entities. So divide and conquer, divide and rule, easier to control and suck the wealth. Since the Iranian resilience stemmed from the revolution, and after, even amid sanctions, they were evolving and developing their educational and scientific, industrial and commercial capabilities, which is translated to a strong, diverse, developed industry and sectors of scientific or industrial sectors. Iran become from renter economy to non-renter economy. It depends on diverse kind of industries, agriculture, commerce, and innovative industries, which make it vital for the region and the global industry, global economy. So Iran, with that kind of links to global trade blocks, which we see in Asia or in the BRICS or in the it make a lot of countries and a lot of these multilateral trade blocks look at Iran with genius kind of global geopolitical position, needed by the region, needed by India, needed by Pakistan, needed by Russia, needed by China. And this is hence we hear the message from the Chinese and the Russian and the United Nations when they said this is illegal sanctions.
Okay.
And
stay with me on that, because I want to pick up right there with Syed Mohsen about the illegality of what Russia and China, they are saying about the snapback mechanism. Let's talk about the role you see Russia and China playing in helping Iran offset this, and also the realization perhaps by Moscow and Beijing that what is happening to Iran could also happen to them, that would make them even more adamant about supporting Iran in this.
Russia and China are very well aware that, in a way, China is next, but Russia is already on the rack. The Americans have basically initiated the war in Ukraine, whatever they want, cover they want to put on it. They're the ones who encroached on Russian territory. So the Russians are already under sanctions, nearly as many as Iran. They're under attack directly through Ukraine and the war they've opened up there. They have also, of course, been sanctioned so that their economies and the de-dollarization processes and the BRICS process and the Eurasian Access process is broken. America is trying to cut off all trade routes that the Russians are trying to build up. So it's in the Russians' interest to create even more stronger alliances with Iran. And with this big deal, one hopes that the $25 billion deal another rapid step to that. The cooperation between Russia and Iran in terms of technology, in terms of satellites, in terms of creating alternatives to anything that relies on America is absolutely vital. And I think that Eurasian Axis needs to develop these systems and alternatives even more rapidly. And the reality is that a dying American empire, of course, is collapsing from within. You can see the civil crisis within America. You can see the civil crisis within Israel. So this is a race against time, even from them. Powerful as they are, the fact is there are fault lines and cracks appearing in the empire. And Iran, they need to, of course, destroy Iran as quickly as possible, and the Chinese ideally as well, if they can. That's in their heads, that they need to do that militarily is definitely on the agenda. And to suck the world into a global war where the economy collapses is also seems to be very much on their agenda, because they have no other thing in their minds other than dominance. So I think that now for Iran, they need to double down and I think that needs to also recognize something deeper, Marcia. One thing is that Imam Khomeini gave Iran a vision. He gave them a dream. He gave them a prophetic dream, and he revived that prophetic dream, which has a cultural and a spiritual and a social base to it, which is actually anathema to the Western neoliberal transhumanist dream. Because there is a dream that the transhumanist West, Zionist West, is pushing. These wars in Gaza, the war on Iran, is part of that. And of course, the Iranian people must and do, I think, recognize that traditional culture, family, spirituality, community, those old school values, the prophetic values, this is what is also under attack. They also fear Iran can come up with an alternative, one which isn't relying on the Chinese top-down, totalitarianly heavy surveillance capitalism, and it isn't also the same kind of transhumanist surveillance capitalism, totalitarianism, which is now rising in the West. Iran represents a civilization and a culture and a religious base which can give the world an alternative vision, and that's as much of a reason why it must survive, it must maintain its direction. It shouldn't sell out to the neoliberal enticement which the likes of the Qataris and the Saudis have long since done, and sold out their values and sold out their people, because all this is going to lead to is enslavement of people in a new digital...
Okay, and on that note, Said Mohsen, sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time. Appreciate both of you being with me. Saab Shaf, author and commentator out of Belfast. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. And Marzia Hashemi, goodbye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Good morning to all listeners from around the world. You are tuned into Iran Radio. It's very nice to have you with us. We start this hour's lineup with our radio productions feature. Dialogue will be next. The program looks at the most important conversation between Shiite imams and their followers, questioners, and leaders of other Islamic faith and sects. That will be followed by Ulema's speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. Our varied radio productions feature will be our final program this hour.
And finally, just to have a quick look at the map of Syria itself, we can see that the area in question to the south, so you have Sweda in the white circle, and then obviously extending up towards Damascus and Jerimana, and how the corridor itself would basically link Israel to the far northeast, covering the borders of Jordan and Iraq.
Israel's also considering the Euphrates River as a dependable water source for its occupied territories in a forward-looking perspective. A proposal to connect southern Syria to the Kurdish areas and construct a canal for transporting water from the Euphrates River to the Golan Heights is being contemplated as part of the concept of establishing David's Corridor by the Zionists. In recent years, the new West Asia has seen a rise in competition among various corridors and Israel has put forth several trade and security corridor ideas with this competitive landscape. One of these ideas is a plan for a corridor known as David's Corridor, which aims to connect the Kurdish regions of Iraq and Syria, and then the Druze regions of Syria to Israel. The Druze majority areas of southern Syria, in particular in Rif Dimashq and Soweto province, are considered by the Israeli regime to be the closest areas to the interior of Syria in terms of security, with the potential for long-term investment in the implementation of these plans and programs.
There have been moves recently when there were clashes between the Druze factions in Jarumana, which is to the southeast of Damascus, that Israel would intervene to protect the Druze, and the Druze have become sort of a protected minority in Syria by Israel. You will notice that HTS are not going near the Druze, they are protecting them. Of course, they don't really care about the Druze. They just see the Druze as a means to actually advance closer to Damascus.
The Druze, a religious minority that separated from the Ismailis in the 5th century, have a rich history of presence in the Levant, especially in the southern regions of present-day Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine, spanning over 1,000 years.
I mean, you have the leadership being managed by NATO and the United States doing all they can to try to tamp down on these sectarian tensions. But then you have their followers, their goon squads, literal death squads that ravaged Syria for years, rampaged into religious minority communities, slaughtering people, forcing them to start their own militias. And they're on the loose now.
Their significant role in the emergence of modern Syria, conflicts with the French government for Syrian independence, and contributions to Arab nationalism in the early 20th century have cemented the Druze's position on the Syrian political scene, with figures like Sultan Pasha al-Atrash holding strong historical significance in Syrian nationalism. But why are the Zionists currently in a hurry to establish such a corridor and in this process have initiated a new occupation, massacred the people of southern Syria, suppressed their protests, and attempted to fuel ethnic tensions?
Which is basically a channel up the eastern border of Syria, linking with the Kurdish separatists in the northeast under the control of the US, but also acting as a settler proxy for Israel in that area, close to the east of the Euphrates, and eventually to link up with the Euphrates in Iraq. This is the Greater Israel Plan, and this is what Israel is basically working towards right now.
In the coming years, the world will witness significant changes in the trade routes connecting the East and the West. There's fierce competition among various well-known corridor plans that have been mentioned many times in the media. The most famous of them is the One Belt, One Road initiative, often referred to as the Silk Road of the New Era, proposed by China, which aims to connect Chinese soil with Iran, the Middle East, and ultimately the European market. Which countries will be involved in this connection? Could Syria, with its extensive history, once again serve as a transit highway and a passage corridor between the East and the West? Ever since Benjamin Netanyahu proposed the India-Israel Corridor Plan at the United Nations, which aims to pass through the Persian Gulf Arab states and eventually connect to European territory through the occupied territories, experts have considered it as the main competitor to China's New Silk Road, which follows a similar corridor through China, Iran, Turkey, and Europe. Given there's greater likelihood of China's New Silk Road plan being implemented compared to the New Delhi-Tel Aviv corridor plan, the Zionists consider David's corridor as a suitable disruptor against the China-Europe corridor, a plan aiming to directly challenge the interests, integrity, and stability of Iran, Iraq, and Syria. Despite their apparent support for the new Syrian government and their recognition of it as an important member of the Arab League, most of the Persian Gulf countries are not likely to be upset about the weakening of Syria through the implementation of David's corridor and the decline in the importance of the Silk Road route in favor of the India-Israel corridor. The development and progress of the southern Persian Gulf countries have historically been impacted by the instability, war, and insecurity in the northern Persian Gulf countries over the past century, and as a result, they will strive to prevent countries like Iraq and Syria from becoming a hub for connecting major trade routes between China and Europe. If Syria achieves complete political stability and preserves its territorial integrity, it has the potential to once again become an important transit route in the China-Europe corridor, just as it did in ancient times. A road and rail route passing through Iran and Iraq that is connected to several highways and railways in Syria and has the potential to connect to European soil through two possible routes. The first route involves passing from east to west Syria, reaching the ports of Latakia, Tartus, and Banias, and then using the sea trade route to southern Europe. The second involves reviving the railway line from south to north Syria, similar to the famous Hejaz Railway during the Ottoman Empire, which would connect the trade route to Turkey and then eastern Europe. Implementing such a plan could bring significant economic benefits to the Syrian people, help maintain the country's integrity, and enable Syria to rejoin the international community as a stable country, free from insecurity and chaos. However, the Zionist regime is actively working against Syria's interests in the transformation of the country into a transit highway on the east-west trade route of the world by planning to create a separatist corridor. Although the heroic people of Syria, after enduring 14 years of civil war, are still expressing dissatisfaction with the new government in Damascus and have refrained from openly opposing the new Jolani government in order to maintain relative peace and prevent further conflict, they have courageously confronted the new Zionist invasion and occupation in Kenitra, Dara, and Rif Dimashq from the outset, and despite the silence and inaction of the current Syrian government, people have actively resisted the Zionist enemy, thwarting their dangerous attempts to divide Syria and establish the David's Corridor. Numerous Syrian youth have tragically lost their lives or sustained injuries in protests against the establishment of Israeli military bases in southern Syria. Given that the fall of Bashar al-Assad and the rise of the coalition led by Tahrir al-Sham are viewed by many as a resurgence of Sunnis in power in Syria, the Israeli regime has sought to exploit identity divisions within the country, particularly among the Druze, Christian, and Alawite religious minorities in its endeavors to further its interests. In the midst of these conflicts, Israel not only announced its support for the Druze forces fighting the new government in Damascus, but also carried out significant bombardments of military positions in Syria, highlighting its intention to exploit the socio-political divide in the country. Currently, despite the presence of the Jolani security forces in the Druze areas south of Damascus, in agreement with the Sueda Druze, which includes a selection of the province's security forces from local residents and the retention of weapons by the Druze armed groups, has resulted in the acknowledgement of Sueda province's relative autonomy in future political landscape of post-Assad Syria. situation that also provides Israel with the potential to utilize it for future destabilization of Syria.
Attacks on the Kurds, as we saw yesterday in Manbij, must be stopped. It's a commitment of the international community towards those who fought bravely against ISIS. It's also a commitment for the future of Syria.
Taking a geopolitical perspective on Syria's eastern neighbors brings to light the significant economic and energy aspects of the David's Corridor project. Israel is seeking to exploit the differences between the Kurdish and Druze minorities and the Arab, Turkish, and Persian majorities in Syria, Iraq, Turkey, and Iran to incite confrontations between the minorities and the surrounding majorities. The Kurds and Druze hold deep historical roots in the region, while Israel is perceived as an externally introduced entity that does not align with the ethnic and geographical makeup of the area. Should the Kurdish and Druze minorities align with Israel and synchronize their interests, they'll likely be drawn into conflicts with regional governments and ethnic majorities, resulting in detrimental long-term consequences and bloodshed that would not serve the best interests of the Kurdish or Druze communities. Kurdistan region of Iraq, an autonomous region, possesses significant oil and gas reserves as well as ample water resources, providing potential leverage over the central government of Iraq and neighboring countries like Iran and Turkey. This strategic location has long been viewed as a potential tool for political maneuvering by Israel to exert influence and pressure on major Middle Eastern states. The lack of national unity and cohesive ties within Iraqi society, combined with the central government, has historically created opportunities for external influence, in particular from Israel, and the prospect of Kurdish autonomy or independence has been perceived as a threat to Iraq's territorial integrity and a potential security risk extending even to the western borders of Iran. Despite some analysts expressing optimism about the future of Syria and its unity, the current tense situation and the potential future events raise serious doubts about the country's prospects. The tragic incident of March 2025 in the western coastal region of Syria, predominantly inhabited by the Alawites, which resulted in loss of hundreds of Syrian lives, highlighted the ongoing instability that still persists in the country. The violence was sparked by alleged attacks from armed groups loyal to the former Syrian government on security forces associated with Jolani, leading to a devastating loss of life among civilians, and if this trend persists, it could potentially be exploited by foreign actors, in particular Israel, for their own strategic interests.
So they funded the jihadists everywhere. Exactly. And by the way, we made Al-Qaeda. I think everyone understands this. We made Osama bin Laden. We made the overthrow in Syria where they're saying, oh my God, it's HTS. What do you think? This was what Obama tasked in 2011-12. Jihadists.
This situation and the concerning prospect of Syria's imminent collapse is a direct consequence of the absence of a strong and stable government in the capital and the deep-seated cultural and social disintegration within the nation.
That's the sphere that we would call a security zone for Israel. Now, cannot that all be accomplished? Not immediately, but from the Israeli standpoint, the key to success is the destruction of Iran, which in their minds is the single opponent left in the region that can put up resistance, because they think they can bully Saudi Arabia and the Emirates into doing whatever they want.
Syria has now become a country that has lost a large part of its conventional armed forces following Israeli assaults shortly after the fall of the previous government. Furthermore, the country's vital port and shipping infrastructure has been extensively damaged, exacerbating the already dire situation for the populace in areas beyond the control of the Jolani administration, leading to widespread livelihood issues and severe lack of essential infrastructure. In other words, the Zionist regime's stated goals may not simply be the occupation of this vast land, but rather the domination and expansion of influence within this vast region. The combination of these issues and challenges is leading to Israel, perceived as a common enemy by the Syrian people and other Muslim nations in the region, embarking on a highly concerning occupation plan and laying the groundwork for its implementation.
They had their patches, ISIS and Al-Qaeda patches, on their arms. They were chanting obscenely the name of God whilst they murdered people in cold blood, many hundreds of them, maybe thousands of them. And yet, this massacre of the minorities in Syria over the last few days is virtually unreported on Western media, particularly in those countries that did the most to put these maniacs into power, to usher the black flags of ISIS and Al-Qaeda into Damascus. Their media, so tightly controlled, they're not even reporting a massacre of Christian people, of Alawi people, of Shia and Druze people, by their clients, by their agents, by the people they armed and funded.
The Davis Corridor stands out as one of Israel's significant tools and plans aimed at exerting a substantial influence on the geopolitical and political dynamics in the region, particularly within Syria. This plan, considering the unique identities and historical gaps of the countries in the region, with a particular focus on Syria, which is located on the borders of occupied Palestine, is expected to greatly influence Israel's geopolitical future and aims to capitalize on the opportunities arising from the Syrian crisis over the past 15 years.
Things that I've said, no, they don't mean nothing at all. Time just flies by when I'm with the one I love. Even sunlight makes it through the dark in a cold, misty sky. Won't smile. I know it's been a while since I fell down.
have to have a very fair assessment of this academic and intellectual icon of early Islam.
His impact is more pronounced in jurisprudence that he formalized.
And tens of thousands of statements and teachings have reached us from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today, we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam, was an incredibly prominent character in the history of the Muslims. He benefited humankind with his highly scientific achievements, many of which had never been seen before by humanity. Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam's instructions in the acts of worship and transactions and his contribution in the field of legislation were amazing achievements that had not occurred before amongst the Muslim masses. And his eminence also had a positive and active share in the establishment of human culture and civilization. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, the son of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, an individual who was divinely appointed by the Almighty Allah, was known to have improved the general public lives of the people and the Muslims, and he was an individual, a divinely appointed Imam, a man from the household of the Holy Prophet, who enhanced human thoughts and discovered many of the secrets of this universe. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So, dear listeners, we are humbly speaking about the dialogues of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. There's a very interesting dialogue that occurs between Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and the Umayyad Caliph Al-Walid ibn Abd al-Malik. So, one time, Al-Walid ibn Abd al-Malik, he came to visit the city of Yathrib, or the city of Medina. And so his representative, Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, was supposed to expand the Prophet's masjid at the orders of Al-Walid ibn Abdul Malik. And so when Al-Walid traveled to the city of Medina, he came to the Prophet's masjid, and he saw that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was upon the pulpit, and he was giving a lecture on geography. So amongst all of these great students and these aged individuals, elderly people who were learning from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, all of these hundreds of students, there was one very young boy who was about 3 years old. Now, this boy, of course, is Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, who was attending the lecture of his father, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. And so it was really interesting, while Al-Walid was looking upon all of these students, he asked Umar ibn Abdul Aziz who this young boy was amongst all of these men, and Umar ibn Abdul Aziz answered, "He is Jafar ibn Muhammad." And of course, this is Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And so Al-Walid was astonished. He went over and he said, I want to ask some questions to this boy. So he asked the boy, what is your name? Again, this is Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, who's only 3 years old. And Imam Sadiq answered with complete fluency and eloquence that my name is Ja'far. And so then Al-Walid asked Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, do you know who the owner of logic was? That meaning, who is the founder of logic? And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam apparently answered that Aristotle was named as the owner of logic. His students and followers named him so. And then Al-Walid asked a second question. He said, who is the owner of Almaz? And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he said that this is not the name of someone. It is actually a collection of stars, which are called Dhul Ayna. And then finally, you know, of course, Al-Walid ibn Abdul Malik was completely astonished that a three-year-old was able to answer questions in such a manner. He asked one more question. He said, do you know who the owner of Al-Siwak is? And so Imam Sadiq alayhi salam answered that this is the nickname of Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, who was a companion of my great-grandfather, the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. And in this manner, Al-Walid ibn Abdul Malik was amazed. He was astounded at the prowess and knowledge and sheer vastness of the knowledge of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, who was only 3 years old, again proving the fact that the divinely appointed, infallible, and immaculate Imams have a knowledge which surpasses the knowledge of all other people. This is Dialogue, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio, our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
And, you know, we have different narrations from the Imams, but I would like to summarize a very famous and a lengthy hadith from Umar ibn Hanzala, where he asked the Imam about a situation, and then he comes up with follow-up questions, you know, and this is where Imam is guiding. At this stage, do this and then do that. Umar ibn Hanzala's narration. Umar ibn Hanzala asked the sixth Imam that, you know, if there are two Shias who have an issue in matters of inheritance, they cannot come to you. You know, the Imam is not accessible or they are in some other city. What do we do there? What should they do? Can they go to a judge appointed by this government of the tyrants? And Imam said, no. Then what should they do? Imam says they should go and find out someone from us who is reliable and who has the knowledge of what we have said as halal and haram. And so the discussion goes on. You know, he says, you know, then we come to the point where we hear a hadith from you. And then we see that, you know, both the narrators are from your side and they are Shia, reliable. But the content of both are contradictory. Then what do we do? This is the process of educating the companions during the days of the sixth Imam, how to handle the hadith and the problems and challenges which come in. The Imam says that then look at the two narrators. Follow the one who is more just, more erudite, knowledgeable, more truthful in hadith, and the one who is more cautious. Ihtiyat is better than getting into problems. Umar ibn Hanzala, you know, may Allah bless him, he doesn't stop there. He says, well, both are just, both are erudite, both are truthful, and both are cautious in narrating hadith. Then what? Then Imam says that if both are just and accepted by the community, you know, that, yeah, then go and see who is accepted by the community. He says, well, if both of them are on that same level. Then Imam says, then look at the opinion which has a consensus in your community and follow that and ignore the isolated view. What do? We say, oh, four marajas say this is not allowed. One marja says this is allowed. I like this, I'll go there. Baba, you have to look at the consensus in the community of the ulama. Not go with the, you know, isolated views. This is the bala even these days. And then he goes on. He says, what if the two famous hadiths from your both you and your father has been narrated by trustworthy ones? Then another, then he says, well, then see and compare both narrations according to the Quran and the Sunnah which has already been confirmed for you. See which is in line with the Quran, with a very clear verdict of the Quran and the Sunnah which has been accepted, and see which opinion is against the Amma. Al-Amma, the Sunni view. He says, then you should basically discard the one which is against the Quran and the confirmed Sunnah, and the one which is according to the opinion of the Amma. You stay away from it. Then Ibn Hanzalah goes further. He says, what if, you know, both ahadith has supporters among Sunni jurists, some of them also on this side, and someone, there is a conflict among them also. And this is where Imam said, then see which one of these jurists among the Amma are closer to the rulers. They are part of the government's camp. You know, discard their side of the opinion and take the opposite one.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Ilm-e Fiqh az ulum-e sharifiye islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. We're welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
بندگی فقط در برابر خدا بود بشه میگیم ایاک، یعنی فقط تو رو بندگی میکنیم.
Servitude is only for God. We say ایاک meaning we worship only you. We also acknowledge the laws of nature. It means gravity, repulsion, etc. But we are not servants of the laws. We are servants of the one who has embedded these laws in nature. If there are laws of gravity, repulsion, chemical compounds, powers, and energies in nature, it is you, that is God, who placed them there. Although worship is from us, the act of worshiping also requires help. We say, إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ, we are your servants, but it is not possible without your help.
داریم که و ما کننا لنهتدی لولا ان هدانا الله، اگر تو من هدایت نمی‌کردی که.
There is a narration which says and we would not be guided if Allah had not guided us. If you had not guided us, we could not have been your servants. By the thanks of power of Allah, I stand and I sit. I myself stand up, I myself sit down. But by strength and power of Allah, with the divine strength and power, with the force that you gave me, I stand and sit down. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.